In an effort to provide some closure to this long-running series, we hired a team of narrative consultants to assist us with the finale. After carefully studying the eclectic makeup of our audience and the idiosyncratic nature of our program, they said,
"Are you fucking nuts?"
refunded our retainer, and informed us that it would be fundamentally impossible to come up with an ending that would satisfy everybody. They also informed us never to set foot in their offices ever again. This morning, our attorneys informed us that the narrative consultants had petitioned for a restraining order. Well, you can't please everybody. Because there are only 5 types of endings, we have decided to avoid a David Chase-style controversy. We are offering 5 different endings for our listeners. It remains our belief that at least one of these endings will satisfy those who have tuned in for many years. It is also quite possible that none of the endings will satisfy you at all. We take the risk. Number 1. The explicit ending, in which all plot threads are wrapped up.
I'm a failure. A wash-up. No friends, no family. Not even a radio show.
Don't worry, my cutie patootie. You have me.
Doris, darling, what are you doing here? You don't hate me anymore?
I only despised you when you coughed without covering your mouth.
Shall we make a new life, cupcake?
Only if you walk me into the sunset.
I haven't walked in years.
Then let's crawl.
I wouldn't crawl into the sunset with anyone else.
Wouldn't it be nice if we...
Number 2. The twist ending, in which an unexpected revelation is unveiled at the last minute.
I'm a failure! A wash-up! No friends, no family, not even a radio show!
Mr. Segundo, you never had a radio show. For the past 10 years, you have spent your life living inside a large dome.
What?
It's all been a government experiment about the effects of social isolation and reading too many books on the individual mind.
But the broadcasts, the many introductions, who was listening to all this?
All transmitted to a team of academics and sociologists. I'm sorry.
Fan mail!
All faked. If it's any consolation, you provided invaluable data for our team of experts. You helped tremendously in furthering our understanding of human behavior.
But why?
Why not? I'm afraid some things in life are bigger than you.
Number 3. The open ending, in which the final moments are left to the audience's interpretation.
I'm a failure. A wash-up. No friends, no family. Not even a radio show. What's that noise?
The heart stands tall and rhythmic. The 4-square beat rocking against the American tundra.
Doris, what's happened to your voice? You're talking poetry.
We ordered the turkey sandwich.
I don't see what that has to do with anything.
The freedom to spread mustard.
The freedom to tune out gibberish. What are you talking about?
The stars sprout in the sky. Turkey on rye. Blinking like a delicatessen in the dead of night.
Number 4, the unresolved ending, in which the main conflict is left unanswered.
I'm a failure, a wash-up, no friends, no family, not even a radio show.
Number 5, the long view ending, in which we learn what happens to the characters in the future.
I'm a failure, a wash-up, no friends, no family, not even a radio show.
You're still saying that after 30 years?
Thank you. And, okay, thank you all for coming. We're going to distribute we have a lot of cookies, and they have to be eaten, so please
pass these along.
These are the very same cookies you saw today on Twitter in the form of uncooked dough.
In the form of uncooked. And then there was a picture of them being cooked. So like, now we see the transmission from digital to reality.
You saw sort the, of like the baby book. Pictures, and now they're graduating from college.
Yes.
And now they're all going to
and
die.
And they need to be sent away to your stomachs. Yeah. So please. Anyway, John, how are you doing?
Hey, Ed. I'm doing very well.
Oh, yes. We're
thank
supposed
you.
To talk. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on the show again, and thanks for sharing your swan song with me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no worries. No worries. So... this book, you know, you have this 46-year-old woman. She's named Lisa Brown.
Mm-hmm.
She enters another life very early on in the book. She's put on some weight. She trades in this, you know, cracked Volvo, or cracked Honda. There's a Volvo that comes later with a Dodge Intrepid. She sees her son Silas, who has died in her previous life, suddenly is alive in this new one.
I think what you're not explaining is it seems to be a parallel universe. All this happens instantaneously, and she's transferred into this apparent other world.
Yes, apparent. And which leads me to my initial question. I mean, she could be inhabiting a parallel universe. This could be a sort of psychological projection. This could be a maternal fantasy. It could be any number of things. You leave this up to the reader. I'm wondering, as author, if you knew with any certainty what this was all about.
I aggressively and definitively refuse to know.
I'm very confident.
I'm very confident in the rightness of not knowing.
Uh-huh.
I'll put it that way.
Okay, but how do you get inside the head of a character when you don't exactly know what the condition of that head is, or do you?
Does anyone know the condition of their own head or the meaning of the circumstances?
Do you know the condition of your own head?
Of course not. Okay. I think the it's a sort of arch sci-fi metaphor for the kind of feelings of dislocation that all of us have in a less obviously nerdy way.
Yeah. Well, it seems that the very ambiguity of Elisa would sort of allow, as I suggested, the reader to find her own way into what this is all about. And I'm curious, you know, were you thinking more of the reader in mind with this book? I mean, some of your other books have dealt with minutia or quotidian life, such as Mailman, to very alarming degrees in that wonderful book.
Alarming quotidianness.
Yes, exactly, exactly. You know, in the case of Elisa, I'm wondering, you know, did that uncertainty allow you to connect with the reader perhaps more than your other characters?
That was my hope. I mean, my goal in presenting this conceit or this unsolvable dilemma to the character is she ends up quite logically, because she's a scientist, searching for both the meaning and the cause of what has apparently happened to her. But in the process, it forces her to do other types of searching of the self that she was previously unwilling to undertake.
Got it. So there's this framing shop in the book run by a guy named Larry. And this intrigued me quite a bit because I said to myself, well, how can a framing shop exist in a small town after the 2008 recession? It leads me to learn, I wonder if this is possibly a fantasy. I mean, I think there's something romantic.
You're
about
on to me.
There's a romantic guy, something romantic about a guy named Larry. I think you and I can both agree with about that.
Sure.
But I mean, I wanted to ask you where this sort of came from. Do you know of a framing shop in a small town that is financially successful, or does Larry kind of have a sort of another business of some sort? And of course, Elisa as well does all sorts of naughty things with him, and we only really sort of see him through how Elisa observes him in that Korean cafe and so forth. So I'm curious about how the origins of Larry and how you sort of stuck your thumb in the nose of present economic realities.
This is a curious thing to fixate on, I must say.
Well, but I'm a curious person. But I've written a curious book.
Thank you. There are several functioning frame shops in my town. It didn't seem terribly unusual, but the framing bit is. I don't know why he's in a frame shop. Maybe has anyone read the Stephen Dixon story, The Frame? It's essentially a joke about a frame story, and a guy goes into a frame shop, and this reminds him of something that happened with his sister in the past. And the frame of the story is a frame. So maybe I had that in mind as like a goofy meta device. But in any event, the plot device you're talking about is that this in her old life, what she considers to be her real life, she is having an affair with this guy Larry from the frame shop, whom she met because she brought some art that she was trying to make in to be framed, and the art was sort of therapeutic art to deal with the death of her son. And in this new world where her son never died, this guy doesn't know her. And so she tries to get it on with him, and it doesn't go as planned.
Yes.
But I like the idea of kind of a quiet business that the whole point of it is not about the content. It's about the context.
Yes. So it's about the framing.
Exactly.
I see. So, I mean, the artistic aspirations that Elisa has in this book, which aren't necessarily totally fulfilled until we sort of see a little bit of near the end, but basically she sort of has this studio, is not really doing much about it. Why is it that art represented, of course, through Elisa's painting, and then transferred mm-hmm. later on to Silas and his video game company. Why is this the sort of the benchmark with for these characters who are in such disarray to try to find themselves? I was curious why this seemed to be the motive for these characters.
Well, I'm always kind of interested in this idea that that art, creative effort, is a form of therapy for people, and that does not always, in fact, usually doesn't create good art necessarily. That the kind of self-criticism required for making
true
good
artists.
Art, yeah, is maybe not compatible with the needs of a sort of a self-therapeutic process. So in each of these worlds, I gave the creative output to one or the other character, as one of them is dealing with the death and her own possible culpability in it, and the other is dealing with his horrible childhood for which he blames her.
Yes.
She doesn't get to do art in the world where he's alive.
Yes. But it's interesting that you call it therapy in light of all of the Wilhelm Reich references throughout the book, some sly quotes. There's this kind of crazy therapist named Amos who is actually using very Reichian like techniques with the whole idea of like blame yourself first,
right,
which comes from Reich. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that that exists side by side with art, and it makes me wonder, well, is Larry, who we were talking about earlier, is he offering a form of therapy in terms of his sexual escapades? But I'm curious about where the Reich interest came from. I mean, he's known as both one of the most important therapeutic forces of the early 20th century, but simultaneously, he's also something of a huckster.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. I haven't read him extensively. I've read some of the book that quote comes from, but I read enough to use him as a motif, but not enough to actually know what the hell I'm talking about. But the book, in a way, is about the entire book is about ways of perceiving experience and the extent to which people choose, no matter how hard we think we're working to understand the truth about our lives, we're engaged in a form of self-serving narrative making.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is, you know, this whole process, which I think is hidden from us a lot of the time in real life, I'm sort of foregrounding in this book by giving her an extra life, an extra version of her life to compose. And, you know, she seems to be screwing it up just the same way she screwed up the other life, which is, I think, what we would all do if we were given a second chance.
But is she entirely screwing it up? I mean, this book has some fairly damning things to say about technology, starting from the first technological implement we see, this camera that has all about a year worth of photos on it. Mm-hmm. And there is a sort of interesting domestic dispute when all of the photos disappear. And the fact that these photos have not been transferred over says something about what our relationship is to memory through technology.
Sure.
And we see later on, of course, she sees a guy who's looking down at his phones over the last dregs of his meal. And of course, there's the video game motif as well.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm wondering why this notion of technology is almost defining many of these characters. Do you mm-hmm. think we're just now in this realm and fiction has to wrestle with this vital point of living?
I mean, I don't think of technology as a motif that's sort of extrinsic from psychology and emotion and that which has to be addressed. Rather, I wanted to sort of bring it into the fabric of the book in the way that it might naturally do so for nerdy people like this family.
Yeah.
And my wife said she was very proud of me with the camera thing. What the deal with the camera is that they just never put the photo, they never print the photos or put them on the computer or anything. They're just all on the camera. And everyone, they want to look at pictures, they just look for the camera and then they pick it up and they just go like this for a while. And then Elise's mother-in-law appears to have deleted the photos of the child who has died. And for whatever reasons, we don't really understand. But
She just could have been messing with it.
Maybe
not.
And Elisa ends up she realizes that if she really wanted that the files are still on there. When you delete a file from say a hard disk or a memory card or something, all that changes is the bit of information that tells the computer or the camera that the photo is there. It's still there. It just can't be seen anymore.
Yeah.
So this for me was kind of a metaphor for the things that we try to put out of our heads that are still there. And the reason my wife is proud of me is because I'm a photography nerd. So, like, I would never in a million years treat photographs like this. I have to download them on my computer and then edit them and then disseminate them to a million different places and print them out and, you know, and flog them in front of people. And I think, you know, it was really a stretch for me to realize that not everyone is like this.
But it's interesting that you established very early on this idea of holes that can be found, because when we get to the end of the book, there are sudden moments or pockets of Elise's existence that start to disappear. The narrative actually jumps forward and suddenly she wakes up in another place, or the action moves to this. So it's almost like...
A chapter actually begins with the sentence, time sped up.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, how the idea of grappling with technology creates this sort of naturally mimetic end. Is Elise's life sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, do you think?
I wouldn't say that. I think that, you know, I read a lot about the multiverse in preparing for this book, and Brian Greene's idea is not only are all these possible universes possible, but they're actual, that they exist. Not like only in theory, like if you went out into space and you just kept going, you would arrive in the universe where you did not, it's everything's the same except you didn't bake cookies tonight, you know? Yeah. And so...
And you weren't being interviewed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm sitting here alone pretending to field questions from an invisible man.
Well, Batsagrino was going on for another 6,000 shows.
We could do this all night.
Yeah,
but my point is that that this idea that there are that possible worlds, possible memories, possible possibilities of life are just out of reach is interesting to me. It's emotionally interesting to me. So, I mean, the early drafts of this book were more sci-fi, that they focus more on her efforts to figure out definitively what has happened to her. And that sort of faded into the background as the metaphorical possibilities of that search became more important to me.
Yeah. You mentioned Brian Greene earlier. William James, you name check in the book. Did you simultaneously cheat on him as you did with Reich?
I have read more James than Reich, but I was cheating on him for sure. I mean, and she does too, because the woman who brings up Henry James, he was the guy who, William James, coined the term multiverse. He meant something else. He meant an alternate universe of moral possibility. But that dovetailed so nicely with the bigger themes of the book that it wasn't really a cheat. In fact, it was brilliant.
So the author says.
So the author says of his mistakes.
Actually, no. It's cool. No. So when we first meet Derek, he has bare feet. Then, of course, I mentioned this Amos Finley guy, this Reichian therapist who's trying to resolve the fractured marriage.
Yeah.
And he also appears in bare feet. And it led me to wonder, is this sort of a sort of subconscious call for hippiedom or an ascetic new age aesthetic? I mean, I also noticed that there was this sort of Stephen King thing you were doing. I'm wearing good shoes,
right.
sir.
Just checking.
But I also noticed there was a Stephen King aesthetic of like everybody wearing blue jeans, and at the end of the book, Elise is like, "Hey, I'm wearing sneakers to work." So I have to ask you about this. Was this an idea of just like, you know, all why the casual Fridays extending to the entirety of the book?
You've cracked the code.
And I have.
It's a grand sartorial.
The pivotal meaning is there in the feet.
That was completely unintentional. But I think you've talked to hundreds of writers. You are probably aware how many things there are in novels that appear to be as choices that are actually accidents. This happened over and over with my last novel, Castle, where I called a guy comes to the protagonist's house to fix the furnace, and he's clanking around with the flames coming up behind him, and I named him Paul Hefner, and who goes by Hef, and I was actually just thinking of Hugh Hefner, and my editor said, I really love your upstate Hephaestus in the down with the stoking the fires, and I was like, oh yeah, thanks, dude. But I think the choices we make when we are writing and revising, I think once we're sort of immersed in the stuff for long enough, interesting things start to happen that we're not entirely conscious of. And maybe we can tease them out in subsequent drafts.
What was the biggest aha moment you found where you were revising it and you said, oh, I didn't realize I had done that. Let me go ahead and work this in further. Was there any sort of great revelation along those lines?
I don't think there was a great revelation. More, just noticing little things like that. The bare feet I missed entirely, but yeah. But there would be little motifs I was inadvertently bringing up, things that I bring up more than once. I'd maybe notice it and now add it a third time in a different context. So slowly, in this book, I did more revising than anything in a long time. The first draft was very messy and very short, and I spent far more time rewriting it than writing it by three or four times as much, I'd say. But it was all these tiny things that over time added up. I wanted everything to be as rich and associative as possible, so that, you know, everything appeared to be imbued with meaning, even when there was no meaning. Because I think that's a possible definition of insanity, mm-hmm. is that you find meaning where there is no meaning, when the part of your brain that makes meaning can't be turned off.
Yes.
And you think things mean something when they don't. And here she is, for the first time in her life, really trying to figure out what her life means, and it starts to get away from her.
Yeah. Well, I actually wanted to ask you, while we're on the subject of needlessly close reading, since I'm not doing any more of these, I have to rib you. So Reevesport in this book, I thought, oh, well, he's doing a sort of clever riff on The Matrix, Keanu Reeves, right? But then I found that Reevesport was named in Mailman. Which leads me to wonder, are there sort of secret Reevesport stories that you're keeping from us?
No, I think it must have been Mailman, or maybe even before that, where I decided to make a shadow Central New York with certain place names, and I changed the name of the Cougar Lake, where Ithaca, where I live. The version of Ithaca in my books is called Nestor, who is the blowhard from the Iliad.
Yeah.
The old dude who won't shut up.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what Ithaca is like in my mind. I mean that in a good way. I love Ithaca. I've sort of carried them over from book to book as I've continued to write about my geographical area.
So you've got your own Yoknapatawpha map somewhere?
Yeah, well, I don't, but I have to. I don't have it all written down somewhere. I think I want to do an upstate story, and then I start fanning through the old books, saying I need a town that I've used before. So,
no hard encyclopedia cross references.
No. I'm sure that there's many mistakes, so to speak, but I don't think anyone's except you has ever paid attention. So I'm worried about it. I'm sloppy, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. No, actually, I wanted to go back to sort of what you were suggesting earlier. You know, for whatever reason, actually for a number of reasons, this book reminded me very much of Kubrick's adaptation of The Shining.
Okay.
Largely because what he did with that movie, he basically took Jack Torrance's alcoholism, threw that out, and said, no. The movie is about the labyrinthine structures, and that, of course, involves, you know, a physically impossible floor plan for the hotel,
right,
and so forth. And I thought very much of the other character in this, Elisa, and how she's constantly negotiating through layouts and so forth, and finding labyrinthine structures with which to try to pinpoint her life. And it's almost as if the labyrinthine structure is meant to uphold her identity rather than in reverse. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
I almost think of it more as the question of identity is a series of labyrinths that you can't get out of. That no matter how, you know, the farther you go down one, the farther you get from ever being able to come out. So I occasionally will make, just to illustrate to students like how I structure different novels that I've written, I'll make a chart for each one. And I have a little, you know, I have a series of these charts that I sort of trot out it in lectures and so on.
Yeah.
And the one for this book, when I tried to do it, I ends up the timelines just start curling off and going in on themselves like this. And I think of it as, again, this question of identity is kind of a trap. Heisenberg's uncertainty. But you know, when you're looking at the self, and then you think, aha, I can't just look at the self. I have to look at myself looking at the self. And wait, I got to look at myself looking at myself looking at myself. And pretty soon you've lost it. So yeah. I don't think that answers your question. Although, you know, I was reminded when talking about an earlier novel with some students that my second book, The Funnies, there's this bit where it's about a cartoonist who is thinking of and trying to reproduce his father's corny cartoon strip. And he reflects that the wall stoned, that the the layout of the house in the cartoons is purely opportunistic, so that the rooms and he, you know, his father would just create whatever room wherever it needed to be in order to do the scene. And so he tried to map out every possible iteration of the house, and so he had this like tesseract like map of all the possibilities of the house on top of each other, and that became sort of a metaphor for the for his life and the layering of memory. So I was thinking of that again here, this idea of the structure of one's life is this overlay of incompatible things.
Yes, you know? But the Fuddies also had that long room, this sort of almost tube-like room. I talked to you about this the last time we talked. You know, I mean, so location, I think, has been very much
which, of
there.
Course, was a birth canal. No,
I thought so. No. Well, we've answered that question. So you're going to read about video games, this video game passage tonight, mm-hmm. and I actually wanted to ask you about this character, Silas. He runs infinite games, mm-hmm. and he also has an ability to mimic people very well, which reminded me very much of David Foster Wallace. But simultaneously, there's this kind of Jonathan Blow-like independent video game developer blowhard streak in him.
Yeah.
He seemed, of all the characters in this book, to be the most predicated on other people. And I wanted to ask, where did this guy come from? Did he come from looking at figures, public figures, from a peripheral basis?
I don't know. I don't remember when I got the idea. And that, if there was one revision revelation, mm-hmm. it was what I could do with the video game.
Yeah.
And I didn't know when you tweeted that to me the other day about Jonathan Blow. I didn't know who that was, and so I had to Google him, and I was like, oh, it's that guy. This is the guy who designed Braid, the sort of great. It's an incredibly beautiful game. It's sort of like if Mario World were like genius.
Yes.
Sort of.
And you go back in time and so
forth. Yeah, exactly. Yes. And travels in time, and you can, you know, and every level has a different time related trick that you have to figure out in order to complete it. It's very clever.
As documented by Tom Bissell in Extra Lives, who consulted you with this book.
No, I consulted him.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom, I read Tom's book as I was starting this book, and I think that's what made me make Silas a video game designer, in other words, a designer of worlds, because Lisa is trapped in a world she doesn't understand, but it is also a world of her own making. And so Silas, she discovers, the living version of Silas, whom she has not, in the part I'm going to read, has not met. And this is sort of it's taking on more and more weight as the book goes by, that this child, this the adult version of this child who died, now exists in the world she's in, and she has to see him at some point. And she and her husband are estranged from the children, but he won't talk about why. She doesn't know why. She's supposed to know why, but she can't ask him why, or else she will reveal that she, in fact, is faking it in this version of her life. So she finds online an interview with her son in which he talks about video games as an art form. And in a very arrogant way.
Yeah.
And somebody asked me, he says that our need for, that we're pathetic creatures who need a story. We need to make a narrative, and that we can't deal with reality, so we have to make up a story about ourselves. And someone asked me in another recent interview, do you agree with Silas? And my answer was, yeah, I do agree with him, except I think that's awesome instead of lame. You know, I think it's great that we're constantly forcing ourselves to make up stories about our lives. Ultimately, what, at least before she goes and tries to actually meet her kid, she's going to try to play one of his games.
And why don't you read that passage right
sure.
now? Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. And this is at this point in, you know, she has come into this parallel universe and has just decided to fake it. So she fakes her way into learning her job that she doesn't know how to do, which is an administrator in an academic department at a college. And she fakes her way into this weird version of her marriage where she and her husband actually get along, but in a creepy way. And through this bizarre therapy that they have had, and she's refused to do the therapy. She's quitting therapy, which he is freaked out by. And they're kind of nervously dancing around this whole issue, but on an unusually ebullient evening, she just says, "Hey, let's play one of Silas's games," and he's utterly flabbergasted by this. So they go to the mall, and they buy an Xbox, and they buy this game. And actually, one of the things Tom told me when I sent Tom Bissell this chapter, because I'm not a gamer. I've played a few games, recent games like Portal, but I'm not a hardcore like game person. So I sent it to him to see if I got it right. And he sent me like 3 pages of all the things I got wrong, most of which I made most of the corrections, not all of them. But so there's a little, if you're a gamer, it'll really be a little wonky. But one of the things he said was, I can't remember what I called the name of the game, but he said, no, this name is not dumb enough. And he said, video games have this sort of stupid but creative ironic nomenclature, and you have to try to, he said it should have a colon in it, and each thing on either side of the colon should not really have anything to do with each other. So I said, I came up with Mind Crime : Destiny's Mirror. And he said, that's much better. So all right, so they go to the mall and they buy Mind Crime Destiny's Mirror and they bring it home. And the husband is Derek, and the therapist is Amos Finley, who at the reading in Ithaca last night, I kept accidentally calling anus. I don't know what that means, but...
plunging into the depths of Reichian. You
know, yeah,
posterior.
That's right. We're all the way to Dr. Freud there. Okay. It takes Derek about 10 minutes to hook the video game console up to their television set. It's black, and the controllers are black. To Elisa, they look like amoebas, with the various buttons and sticks as organelles. The game comes in a DVD case with a picture on the cover of a man, a young man in t-shirt and jeans, seen from behind, this is the jeans again, peering into a distant yellow light. The box is hard to open, so Derek goes to the kitchen for a knife. This is stupid, he says, but he's laughing to himself. This is what people do on Friday nights now, she tells him, though what does she know about what people do on Friday nights? Inside the box is the game disc, with the title printed on a black background. In a slot on the inside cover is a glossy black paper that reads, Instructions. Find yourself. Derek turns the paper over, looks again at the box. That's it? That's the manual? I guess the game tells you how to play it? Ay, caramba. They sit cross-legged on the carpet in front of the TV, power up the console, and slide in the disc. It whirs. They expect some kind of credits, some title sequence, but instead they hear a click and a whine, and a yellow dot appears in the center of the screen. It expands rapidly, like the picture on an old television, into the image from the cover. This version of the image is subtly in motion. The man is panting, his shoulders heaving, the muscles of his back trembling slightly. He is scratched and bleeding. His clothes are dirty. A bass chord sounds, and then a male voice echoing as though in a cave. Who am I? Then the chord evolves into a slow orchestral dirge and options appear on the screen. Game, explore, controls, options, extras. Explore? Elisa asks. Nah, says Derek, and expertly manipulates the joystick until play is underlined. He presses a button and the menu screen disappears. How did you know how to do that? She asks him. Derek shrugs. He seems mildly embarrassed and pleased. It's the sort of thing you can do, pick up a tool or a gadget or a computer program and just use it. It is, she must admit, a bit of a turn-on, as is his pleasure at his own facility. A few notches more self-satisfaction, though, and it would be insufferable. This is a key to his appeal, confidence bordering on, but not crossing over to, arrogance. Their man is standing in the forest, alert and subtly breathing. A message appears on the screen, prepare to find your destiny. This is the training the girl told them about. They have to teach themselves to run, climb, throw, hit. On-screen icons indicate which controls to use. The screen shows their character, the man, in various environments. A forest, an empty house, a road, a ship, where some obvious task, like scaling a wall or opening a safe, has to be accomplished. He's always shown from behind, his muscles working, his thin hair flopping on his head. Elisa is amazed at the photographic quality of the graphics. It looks like a movie. The training is fascinating and vexing, and the game proper doesn't seem to have really started yet. Derek says, Jesus, are they all this complicated? The girl said no. Jesus. When they decide that they've mastered the controls, or come close enough, Derek gets up and comes back with a bottle of bourbon and 2 glasses. They haven't drunk the stuff together in years, at least not in the world she knows. The ceremony and his bearing suggest they haven't in this one, either. He pours the drinks over ice and they clink them together. To an unusual evening, Derek says. To Silas. The warmth drains from his face, and he turns away from her to the screen. So, are we playing this thing or not? He drinks. Let's. As it happens, they can't both play at once. It's single player only. They take turns manipulating the controls and exploring the world of the game. It is, of course, a mystery. The player is a nameless man who wakes up bruised, beaten, and starving somewhere in a forest. He has nothing in his possession save for a compass, which doesn't appear to work here in the woods, and a creased and torn photograph. I'm, by the way, mocking my last novel here. The photograph is familiar to them both. It is clearly based on the family picture from the lake, the one that Elisa remembers she has left at the frame shop with Larry. Though she hears Derek draw in breath, neither of them remarks on the resemblance. The faces are different, but the poses are the same. During the first 15 minutes, they die repeatedly by falling into holes or out of trees. Only when morning breaks in the game are they able to make their way out of the forest. They do so by following the sound of passing traffic. When at last the man climbs onto a road, Derek says, "So how long are we going to be doing this?" They're both on the second bourbon. Elisa is shocked. It's only 10. She has no intention of stopping. "Oh, I don't know," she says, "another hour?" Derek shrugs. She can see that the game has caught his interest, but he doesn't want to stick with it. It's bothering him. She gets up and refills her glass. She's beginning to get drunk. They flag down a pickup truck driven by a grizzled old man. "Where to?" he wants to know. And they hear the man say, "Wherever." Eventually, the driver buys him breakfast at a diner. Then a waitress comes on shift, tying her apron around her waist, sees the man, and screams. Derek actually cries out and drops his controller. "It can't be," the woman is saying. She backs into the kitchen, weeping. "Rosie, you got a problem with this guy?" says a voice, and the man turns to find a burly biker type standing behind him, cracking his knuckles. There's something sickening about this sound. It is wet and deep, like the popping of greenwood in a fire. "Fight him! Fight him!" Elisa shouts, and when Derek makes no move to pick up his controller, she punches him on the arm. He flinches. "Derek! Derek! We have to fight this guy!" "Let's pause," he says. "Can you pause?" They both try various buttons until they head upon the right one and a menu pops up. Exit. Options. Derek exhales, seeming to shrink to half his size. He says, "I think we've had enough for tonight." "You're kidding!" "Yes. She's a little drunk." He pats her shoulder. "I'm beat, Lisa. I wrote lectures all day." "Oh. You kind of hurt my arm." "Sorry," she says. She glances at the screen, then back at him. "Mind if I stay up?" "Go ahead," he stretches. "Don't forget to save the game, in case you die." "Thank you," she says. And then, "Derek, I'm going out to see them." "See who?" "I bought a plane ticket." He's silent. He's staring not at her, but at the biker on the screen. She says, "In 3 weeks, I'm taking the Friday off." His response is very quiet. "Why?" "Do you want to come? You aren't teaching. You can come." "I don't know." "When was the last time you flew out to see them?" He gets that look, the fear that he doesn't know what's going on. "You know." "When?" She feels reckless. "Just say it." He doesn't reply, just stares at the screen. After a moment, he rubs his face, says, "He could be funny sometimes, Silas." Derek has half gotten up to go to bed and then sunk down again, so that his legs are folded under him as though he's getting ready to pray. "Just cuttingly, shockingly funny," he goes on. "The way he would impersonate people walking by. Do you remember that?" She nods. "Even when he was, Jesus, 8 or 9? He would do these conversations between people at restaurants. Do you remember the old man with the cowboy hat and the girl with him in, what the hell was it? The place that used to be where the subway is now? The Arbor? No, the Terrace. Yeah, with the plastic ivy. He did the Texas accent. Well, now, darling, y'all let me know if you find a tooth in them French fries. Remember that?" "Of course." It's true. Sometimes they laughed at Silas until they cried. He knew exactly what to mock. God forgive them, they even laugh when he made fun of Sam, it's his brother. At the dinner table, faced with a food he didn't like, Sam's chin would drop and tremble, his cheeks collapse, his eyes narrow and moisten. Silas had it down. Sometimes he would even beat his brother to it. As soon as the plate of beets hit the placemat, before his brother had a chance to react, Silas would pull the face, and Elisa and Derek would convulse with laughter. Oh God, it was wrong. It was so wrong to encourage, but it was so funny. She thinks of Minefield, Silas's online alter ego, and she wonders where that part of her son went. By the time he died, it was gone. His mockery wasn't funny anymore. And here, this game, there's no humor in it, yet it compels her all the same. Derek has stood up to leave. He says, "Maybe you could turn the sound down a little." "Sure." He drops to his knee, kisses her on the head. "Good night," he says, and grips her shoulder as though to fix the moment, as though she might run away. "I still don't understand what you're trying to do, and I'm afraid you're going to ruin everything. But I love you." And then he goes to bed. If I can read a couple more pages, like she can finish the game.
Sure.
All right. She only means to play for another hour, then join him. But she ends up playing all night. She doesn't fight the biker in the end. Instead, she backs off, leaves the diner. And while she's in the parking lot, the waitress comes out to find her. Is it really you? She says. She's young and pretty, and Elisa can't help but see her through Silas's eyes. Is this a girl Silas made? A girl he wishes were real? There's a tenderness here in the way the girl's features are rendered. Her red-brown hair, tied back loosely, a nose slightly too large for the face. The way the clean apron nevertheless bears faded stains that can never be washed out, and the way it creases when she gestures, the fibers frayed and weak with age. How is it even possible to evoke these details in a video game? It is impossible, immersing herself in this world, not to feel that she had missed something about Silas. Of course, every aesthetic decision here could not have been Silas's. There's probably a team of programmers, graphic designers, and the like. And yet she feels powerfully that this character, this girl, is the product of her son's mind. This world, the world of the game, is Silas's as well. It is as though she has been allowed to enter into his consciousness, to see the way he sees. It is something he made to satisfy himself, and it feels realer, fuller, than any version of him she was ever permitted to see in life. But then again, how hard had she looked? It's true that up until his adolescence, his emotions appeared to live on the surface. His problem, as they saw it, was impulse control, an incapacity to keep himself in check. His actions, as they saw them, were the unfiltered product of his subconscious. They lived in the world he made by necessity, and he refused to enter the world they wanted him to live in. But he did change around the time he turned 12. He fell quiet and began to brood. And though this made their days more orderly, fewer messes, less violence, fewer fights, it also threw Elisa and Derek into a state of paranoia. What was he thinking? What was he going to do next? His quiet hostility became more disturbing than the acting out once had been, and Sam, who had endured their shared childhood with his wits largely intact, began to show the signs of deep anxiety and, eventually, depression, sallow complexion, sunken eyes, bitten fingernails. Sam hid in his bedroom much of the time while Silas haunted the halls with a kind of regal insolence. He frightened them. I'll skip a bit here. She has stopped drinking, but the night has the quality of a bender, with periods of sudden strong emotion and of blankness and of pointless hilarity. The girl, it turns out, knew the man from a period some months before when she was under the control of some thugs who lived in her trailer park. Then the man had gone by the name Jack, and though he was only passing through, he managed to chase the men out of town and help the girl, Rose, pay her mother's medical bills. Jack, she explains now, wouldn't say where the money came from and indicated that Jack was not his real name. He said goodbye and good luck and disappeared. But now he's back. What happened to him? The man shakes his head. He doesn't know. Rose gives him the only thing he left behind, a torn sheet of notebook paper with a 6-digit number written on it in an unfamiliar hand. It is all, of course, adolescent in conception, but beautiful in execution. Lavishly detailed, astonishingly full. Maybe all games are like this now. What does she know? But every time she tries to enter a building, there's something there for her to see. Every time she approaches a character, that character has something to say. Silas, whose motivations, whose desires were always so inscrutable, has created a world and left it open to whomever might wish to enter. It's late on Sunday morning when she finally comes to the end, a slow trudge up the driveway of a white clapboard house in an affluent subdivision, a knock on the door. There they are, the family in the photo, the people who rejected him, who sent him away because of his choice to become a government spy, a killer. But there was no choice. He'd been framed. And it was the only way out. It doesn't matter, he is told by the family patriarch, who refuses to let him over the threshold, behind which his mother and sister cower in fear. They want nothing to do with him. Go away, they tell him. We don't want you here. Elisa can retaliate if she wishes. She's learned how to do things. She can beat these people to death with her fists, burn their house to the ground. She understands enough now about the way the game thinks to know that this is a possible ending, an acceptable ending. Instead, she turns and walks away. Returns to the diner to collect Rose and take her and her mother away from the terrible little town. At the end, they're standing out in the road, hand in hand, facing the sunset, but not yet moving toward it. The man, exhausted by his efforts, is panting, just as he did at the beginning. The woman's hair is lifted by a breeze. And then a closing sequence. The camera, though of course there is no camera, lifts up as though on a crane, and a distant landscape is gradually revealed. Not mountains, not the sea, but a trailer park, lavish in its dilapidation. Pickup trucks and dirt bikes moving through its ragged streets, a commercial strip populated by crumbling big box retail spaces and empty cracked parking lots, a landfill, dump trucks and bulldozers swarming over it like ants, tiny gulls swooping overhead, a cemetery, weedy and overgrown. That's what lies ahead for the man and Rose and her mother. Suburban decay and ennui, pollution and filth, death and obscurity. Game over. Elisa wonders what sequence she would have been shown had she chosen to set fire to the family home. She turns off the TV and the game console, lies on her back on the living room carpet. She ought to be tired, but she isn't. Instead, her mind is clear. She closes her eyes and thinks. When she hears Derek enter the room, she says, "You're right. About what? I'm going to go talk to Amos. There's no response. She opens her eyes, tips her head back. There he is, upside down. He's staring at her. When she calls the therapist, he tells her to come right over.
All right.
Thank you.
So, if anybody has any questions for Mr. Ledin, by all means, feel free to raise your hand. Ah!
Sung.
I've only read the first page of this book. I just got it yesterday,
but I haven't
gone.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, man.
You know, you could have at least read two, maybe three.
Yeah.
And I felt like, because I've read a number of your books, and this one just like felt very different, like
yeah.
in the way it starts, and just like the voice that you use, it almost sounded like almost Twilight Zone-ish. Like, you know, like you're really telling us what's going on, and like this person's name is this.
Yeah.
Was it like a conscious choice?
Yeah, I wanted to have a bit more of a detached narration. The first draft of this book, I got preoccupied with this notion that my novels were all just boring descriptions of people's feelings, and I became fixated on this idea. And I said, I'm gonna be so chill in this book that there will be no internal monologue. It's just gonna be descriptions of stuff happening. And so I wrote that book, and I gave it to my wife, and she's like, dude, there's no stuff in here. You gotta, you know, where's the emotion? But as a result, I was able to, instead of what I usually do, which is write like a zillion pages and then cut, I was able to build it up. And so I maintained this detached tone, but brought some of that internal monologuing and emotion into it. Because she's a scientist and she thinks like a scientist. Which has limitations in analyzing one's own feelings. So she's trying to impose this detached and emotionless way of seeing to things that are not suited to that type of analysis, essentially.
Actually, in fact, when I read the book, I emailed you, said, dude, that was Richard Matheson all the way. And then you said, I didn't read any Richard Matheson.
No.
So, what kind of background of reading things like Twilight Zone, Richard Matheson, did you have anything along those lines? Was this purely intuitive?
And I have since yeah. you told me, yeah. go read some Richard
oh, yeah.
Matheson, man. So I have, and of course it's terrific. Yeah, I've read lots of classic sci-fi, and I watched every Twilight Zone multiple times, even the horrible rebooted 80s version. And
no, I will defend that, actually. It was just some good stuff in there.
Yeah, I'd watch the whole thing again, I think. Yeah. And the X-Files, you know, and I've always liked genre fiction and sci-fi movies and trashy things. And, you know, I really wanted to, I think a lot of those things, including Stephen King, like, there are some really great ideas in these works. And even when they're crudely presented, it's very exciting to me to consider some of the implications that maybe those writers did not. Or in the case of Matheson, or some of the books that actually did influence this, like Tom McCarthy's Remainder, really are investigating what, that's right, you read that in my class, that it, think about cognition. You know, they're books about literally about the way we think and the sort of mystery of how we think and as you said, the sort of labyrinths that our thoughts can go down.
Sure. Anybody have any questions? I saw. Oh, you're just scratching your. Okay. Ah.
Something that I picked up on. I thought it was so interesting what you were saying about insanity being linked to looking for meaning in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you think that's also a sign of genius? And if so, talking about the thin line between insanity and being a genius, did that factor into the book?
I don't know. I'm a little uncomfortable with that word because the word genius, that is. It's like it's so loaded. But I think you're on to something there. I mean, I think this idea of if you can actually manage to marshal to actually do something with all this meaning that everything seems to be saturated with, and make it into a kind of sense, you know, that's a valuable skill. I think it's what we try to do when we write a novel too. But we're being selective about what things we assign meaning to. So, I mean, this is sort of a meta project because I'm trying to do this with the novel at the same time she's trying to do it with her life. But it's like when you read Shakespeare. And after you read a bunch of Shakespeare plays, it just dawns on you that every single one of them is about putting on a play. It's like it's all about putting on a play, you know? And of course, it's about other stuff too. But on some level, that I feel like almost everything I write is in some way about the creative process itself. So in a way, Silas is creating worlds. And at one more point in the book, she even gets paranoid that he created this one, and that she's in a world that he created. You know, that's how far down that road she goes, overthinking these things. And of course, we are creating, like we were saying before, we're creating our own narratives all the time. This is somewhere between a weakness and a dysfunction, and the thing that makes brilliant art. And the two things are kind of inseparable.
But to triangulate here with your question, your answer, I mean, Alyssa does in fact seek explanation for her condition, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And what strikes me is that the institutions she goes to are sort of corrupt in their own mm-hmm. ways. And I'm wondering if this is sort of a reflection of how you feel the crackpots and the idiosyncratic types are treated these days. That if you have sort of an unusual perspective, that inevitably you are going to go to the broken, corrupt institution, and they're going to push you further down into the abyss. What of this? Yeah.
I mean, I think what we think of as crackpots are, you know, people with a point who don't know how to express it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you know, some institutions, you know, psychology, academia, religion, the various things that she explores, science, you know, these are things that have limitations, and they are self-imposed to keep it from exploding into meaninglessness, right? But that also makes you blind to seeing certain things when you're in that system, when you're seeing through that system.
Yeah.
And so I wanted this to be a sort of not a philosophizing kind of novel, but about the problems of the search for meaning.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Yeah. Any other questions?
It seems to me that, you know, talking about how Alyssa decides to fake it through this alternate parallel version of her own life, that it's also kind of a weird, or at least, granted, it's a concept I've been preoccupied with, which is imposter mm-hmm. syndrome, which is the idea that if you keep faking it and you keep faking it, suddenly you become it.
Like that gangster who drove himself crazy because he decided to appear crazy for the sake of a trial so he could use the insanity defense. So he just was walking around his block and in Brooklyn in a bathrobe mumbling to himself, and pretty soon he was crazy. You know,
if you keep acting the parts of,
you can adopt any role, method acting.
Yeah.
It's also that many successful people, you know, in my experience, that it's almost like the higher they climb in their occupation, the more they don't believe that they either belong there and stuff. So I just wonder if this whole imposter syndrome idea applied in any way to Familiar. I mean, I'm thinking of it just in terms of Alyssa faking it through life. Even Derek and Alyssa together are kind of faking it through mm-hmm. coming up with a good marriage, faking it in terms of the mother-son relationship, things like that.
Yeah, well, I talked to this in another interview, a podcast I did. I don't think it's been aired yet, but we're talking about Capgras syndrome that Oliver Sacks has talked about, where someone who's very familiar to you, your own mother, for instance, they look exactly like your mother, but you know that they're an imposter impersonating your mother. And I feel like it's, again, a very natural impulse that we have that one has lost control over. Because, you know, the sort of the gag about her faking her way through this alternate life is that, in fact, she was faking her way through the real one, too. And so are all of us right now. You know, that it's all a performance, that even if we're the only audience member at times, that we are, there's the self, which is almost impossible to get to, and then there is the thing we construct to present to the world, which we think looks a certain way, and we're mistaken. You know, and so this experience has kind of foregrounded the bizarreness of trying to live among other people in general, particularly in a family, in Elise's life.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you said you read a bunch of genre fiction. Would you read any Rodgers and Lasney?
No.
Because it's funny that one of the series of books has all these like alternate worlds and people who can make worlds. And the video game version of one of the books, which I used to play on my Commodore 64 in the 80s.
Yeah.
You're the man.
Sounds like the video game that you described.
Oh, really?
You wake up in a hospital with two broken legs. You don't know who you are, who beat you up.
Yeah.
Or what happened, and you just have like a little scrap of information.
What's the game called?
Nine Princes in Amber.
Yeah,
I've not read.
There's a ROM emulator for Nine Princes of Amber, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh,
I think. Yeah. I mean, well.
But it's just interesting because the whole premise of the book is that there are these alternate universes that people kind of move through.
Yeah.
And then I figured you must like.
It's like this. The amount of, you would not believe the amount of stuff I haven't read. And probably never will. But you know, I think that these are ideas that kind of seep into the culture. People who, I'm sure I've read people who've read him, and that, you know, these ideas make their way into television and movies and stuff, and into just conversations with people like you that I have at parties. You know, it's like all this stuff is kind of in the air, and I'm grabbing it wherever I can find a piece and reassembling it, you know. So I guess I should, that's adding him to the reading list.
I've read Roger Zelazny.
Yeah.
You have that big fat book with all the Amber stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
They're all like both pulp
novels. Yeah, exactly. They're great.
DL?
I'm curious if when you sort of decided upon this idea of the alternate universe, you mentioned technology and the recurring motif of, you know, the screen, the filter, the camera, just these meta moments of sort of nerds, but not quite. If that was originally a concept you wanted to play with the alternate universe, or just naturally developed because of its ability to coincide?
Yeah, it's the latter, really. I mean, but I had been talking to my wife about this a lot. She was trying to work on a novel that involved a crime, and she just kept coming out of her office going, everyone has cell phones. What am I going to do? Set it in 1975? You know, and maybe the answer is yes, right? It's like, but... I think those of us who, you know, we grew up reading, that I think there was a massive gap between, you know, the world that started, the world of sort of our interfaces with technology that started about 10 years ago and everything before it, that it was, technology was a thing we would interact with sometimes, and now it's just this, what we're swimming in, you know? Like, I didn't even have a cell phone 2 years ago, and now my battery has just run down, and I'm like, what am I going to do? Until I can get to the charger, right? Just because obviously I'll be fine. But I think it becomes the passageway that we're living our lives through. So I wanted to, as I got going on the book, I decided, no, I'm going to have these things be a thing that it's not. I think the reason it's frustrating to us when we're writing and wished that the characters didn't have cell phones, it's that we're thinking of the problems of the past. The kind of problems we would have 20 years ago and trying to apply them to the present. But in fact, there are new problems. It's not just in a different context. They're different problems because we have introduced all this stuff into our lives. So I just wanted to put it all in there. And this includes, you know, there's the phones and there's cameras and there's a guy doing an experiment with a little flange of metal in a lab.
Oh, yeah.
And there's, you know, there's all kinds of little... tests being done to things to see if you can tell something about them, and these ultimately failed efforts to exploit technology to actually make meaning. It turns out it's, in my opinion, no easier to make sense of our lives now than it was before.
I was just going to ask you to jump off of the video game thing. When you describe the building, this SUNY Reevesport where Elisa works, you say, there is a file cabinet, several chairs, bookcases covered with papers and binders. The shades are drawn as if against afternoon light. And I kept thinking to myself, am I playing an Infocom text adventure game? Or am I reading a novel? And I'm wondering, you know, was that something you were thinking about during the course of some of these, especially the descriptions of buildings?
While I was writing this, I actually started to write a short story in the form of an Infocom video game.
Really?
Yeah. And I realized, I couldn't think of a good, I thought it was a cool concept, but I'm like somewhere 10 people in Brooklyn are writing this story right now. And I don't have to do it, but it got me thinking about the way a world is presented to you, and this, you know, Silas's video game, everything she tries to do, there's something there for her to see. So it's like an open world game, and of course your life is kind of an open world game. They have this thing now, there's this thing on the new iPhone where it will fog out every place you have not been.
Yeah.
On Earth, right? And then you can see the lines you cut through existence. And when you look at it, it's like, oh, there I am at the office, my house, and the supermarket over and over and over for years and years and years, right? It turns out that your life is really circumscribed. And I think that the thing about the games is, the world there is circumscribed, but your existence is also circumscribed on the fly by you. And I just found that kind of scary to think about. Because, again, so I think it's a lot of video games now are probably fuller than many human lives.
Or it takes the place of them in many cases.
Yeah, sure.
Is there any... all right, I think we should just call it a wrap, I suppose.
Sure.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Ed.